Okay, so I want to carry on from last week. Probably recap last week. Who was here last week? Good few of you. So Subhadramati last week took us... Well, she was talking more about wisdom, following on from Diabhadra talking about it the previous week. In the context of the threefold path... So, does anybody like to remind us what the threefold path is? Wisdom being the third one, so you've got one for free. Ethics and meditation. Thank you. And Subhadramati last week, she had a diagram up, which I'll reveal in a minute. But do you remember that she was saying that the threefold path reverses a particular kind of trend, a delusive trend that we're normally caught in. Can you remember what that delusive trend was? Three aspects to it, three stages to the delusive trend. What's the root delusion that she was talking about?
Sense of fixed, unchanging self.
Yes, fixed and separate self. Yeah, unchanging, separate self. So the sense that we are a me as a fixed entity and a separate entity from the rest of the universe, separate, ultimately separate, is a kind of delusion. It works relatively well, doesn't it? It works relatively well. You can kind of go about your life, you can have your breakfast, you can get on the number 8 bus, you can come here with a sense of me as a fixed and separate entity. But when you examine it a little bit more closely, just using ordinary kind of reasoning, we kind of know that there's nothing fixed about us. It's quite easy to look at our experience, look at our physical experience, look at our internal mental experience, and recognise that there's nothing fixed there. Yeah, there's nothing substantial that we can get hold of and say, this is it, this is me. Similarly, if you think about being separate, I know that we've got boundaries that appear sort of very defined, like the skin of our body feels as if it's a boundary that limits where we stop and the world begins. But actually, when you think about it a bit more closely, that boundary is very permeable. We're taking in air all the time, we're breathing out air, we're interacting with the environment all the time. We wouldn't exist without the environment around us. That physical boundary has to be in relation to the world around us, otherwise that wouldn't be life. There wouldn't be life. Actually, all things are like that. Even rocks and mountains, which look so fixed, they're interacting with the environment all the time. The edges are always permeable and always changing. But even when... Well, that's just a physical kind of body. But if you consider consciousness, well, where does the boundary actually stop? Where does my consciousness really end? So, for example, I look out, I can see all of you in the room. A little bit of understanding of what happens in the perceptual situation tells me that actually what's happening is there's light falling into my eyes and being interpreted by my brain. So this image of you out there, are you really out there? Is that image being formed out there? Is it being formed in here? If it's being formed out there, does that mean that my consciousness is reaching out? If my consciousness were completely bounded by my head, then how could I reach out and perceive something that isn't inside my head? On the other hand, the image does seem to be formed inside my head. So where is this boundary between inner and outer, between me and the image that I'm seeing? So when you consider consciousness, I mean, that's just a very simple example about sight, but when you consider consciousness, this notion of a fixed and separate self starts to dissolve even more. But Sir Bhadramati's point was that it's not an intellectual delusion. If it was just an intellectual delusion that we've got a fixed and separate self, then I could talk you out of it, or you could talk yourself out of it, and we'd go home enlightened. But it's not an intellectual delusion. It's a gut-level, instinctive misunderstanding of experience. It's a very, very, very deep-seated, pre-conscious delusion. And that delusion causes us to have a limited experience, a limited consciousness. So the whole of the Dharma is about trying to see through that delusion. So last week, Sir Bhadramati was saying, on the basis of that root delusion, let me just reveal the diagram. She was saying, oh, can you see this? On the basis of that root delusion of a fixed and separate self, we have mental states arising. So our mind, as we normally experience it, and the mental states arise on the basis of this delusion. So we have all our thoughts and our feelings and our emotions, our whole inner mental world is rooted in this notion of a fixed and separate self, and therefore we have the minds that we do, instead of an unlimited consciousness. And then on the basis of the mind and the mental states that arise, we act in the world, don't we? So we speak, we act, we interact with each other and with the world around us, and we shape our lives and affect the lives of others, all on the basis of this delusion. It doesn't mean that we always act badly. All it's saying is that as long as we're coming from this root delusion, we're not coming from our true potential, our true innate potential of enlightenment. So we're acting in a limited way. And what she was pointing out is that the threefold path of ethics, meditation and wisdom is reversing this delusive kind of trend, in that with ethics, we're particularly trying to address our actions in the world and move our behaviour more in the line of how an enlightened being would act. So we're trying to act more and more from metta and from mindfulness, from awareness. Yeah. With ethics, that's what we're doing. We're trying to change our actions. What that does is that then that helps change our minds. And then meditation works directly on our minds. Yeah. So with ethics and meditation combined, we're working on this level of our behaviour in the world and the minds from which we behave. So that's what we're doing. But this root delusion, remember, isn't accessible to the ordinary mind. It's not, doesn't exist at the level of, well, it does exist at that level, but it goes much deeper. It's pre-conscious. And so we're not just going to eradicate that or see through the delusion just through ordinary meditation and ordinary ethics. This is where wisdom practice comes along. And wisdom practice gives us reflections that you can practice in meditation, in a meditative state. It gives us views that you can reflect on in your life. Other things that we'll come on to. It's a way of trying to see through this self-clinging at the deepest possible level of our being, to let go at that deepest possible level. So ethics, meditation and wisdom, a very, very standard, simple but profound formulation of the whole of the Buddhist life, of the whole of the Buddhist path, makes sense as a reversal of the unenlightened, delusive trend of our being. Do you see what I mean? That's what Sir Bhadramati was talking about last week. And that's what Subhuti references this in his paper. So all of this seminar is looking at themes arising from a paper that Subhuti, who's the president of the LBC, wrote coming out of his conversations with Bhante Sangharakshita, He's written a number of papers, and this last one, this latest one, is called A Suprapersonal Force. A Suprapersonal Force Coming Through Me. And what he's... The thrust of the paper... Well, would somebody like to say what it is? What's he mean by the suprapersonal force? Somebody who's been here or read the paper.
He's suggesting that a separate level of the nema, so the karma nema is the of the level of our action.
Yeah.
And there's another level transcending that, which we can create the conditions. We can't actually will into our experience, but we can create conditions for it to enter our experience, and it's experienced in such a way as maybe creativity, inspiration,
yes,
something working potentially through us.
Yeah, that's right. So what he's saying, thank you, Sam. What he's saying, that's right, is that if we could see through this delusion, if we could let go... Well, once we see through this delusion, what happens is that there's a sort of letting go that happens in our experience. Because as long as we're trapped in this delusion, and I include myself in this, we have a sense of needing to protect this sense of me. And we protect it in all sorts of ways. We try and build up a life that shores up my sense of myself. But also, there's a sort of subconscious holding on in the body almost. Well, it is in the body, in the guts, where we keep clinging to a sense of me. And many of our thoughts keep rehearsing a story of me. Me, all the time. There's a kind of common pattern to much of our thoughts that keep doing that. Much of our kind of volitional life, our what we want, is to do with me, what I want, or what we don't want. So we keep rehearsing this story of me. So when we see through this delusion, that holding on starts to fall away. That starts to fall away. And no longer are we so preoccupied with me, because we've seen that there's no such fixed entity. That doesn't mean that there's not experience. It just means that there's nothing fixed and separate behind the experience. And the more we can let go, the more something else, a new kind of consciousness, breaks through, arises in our experience. And the qualities of this new kind of consciousness are said to be freedom, joy, real sense of bliss, a sense of spontaneous love, metta that just pours out, energy, fearlessness, because fear arises from wanting to protect me and fearing that I might be threatened. Fearlessness arises. A fear of death, for example, would disappear. And there's, as Sam was pointing out, creativity, unbounded, spontaneous kind of creativity. So all of that is potentially there. The only thing that's stopping us is this me-making, my-making. Yep, that's what's stopping us. And the whole of this dharmic path is trying to reverse that. And that's quite a project, to reverse that. But... well, I was saying in the tea break, I can't think of what else one does with life. What else are we trying to do if not realise our true nature, our true potential? It makes the car and the house and the kids and the holiday and all the other things that we might be trying to fix in our life. Not that there's anything wrong with car and houses and kids and holidays, but it makes them pale into relative insignificance compared to realizing our true nature and helping others to do the same. Yeah. So everything that we think is so vital to me is not. That was all last week, and a bit of a recap of where we've been so far. Yeah. So the whole of this paper and the papers that precede it are talking about how do we do this? How do we actually do this? There's much more that could be said about ethics, meditation, wisdom, about the system of practice. So, for example, another formulation of the Buddhist path, of the system, is this stages of the path. What are the stages of the path? We're in one now. Well, I say we're in one now. We're meant to be in one now. The LBC's year of spiritual rebirth is one of them. So what are the others?
Spiritual death, you said. Yes.
Who's that? Oh, yes, Rebecca, thank you. Spiritual death. So spiritual receptivity. And then there's two more, the first two.
Integration and positive emotion.
So you've got integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual receptivity, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth. Yeah. And you can see them as a mandala, actually. You can see them as aspects of our practice, or you can see them as stages. So that's another formulation of the path, and we could go into exploring that, but we've done that a few months ago, or Maitreya Bandhu was doing that in his Journey in the Guide seminar, which I really recommend. It's online if you haven't heard it. But I want to move on to another theme in this paper, because what Subhuti and Bante say is that if we are to really let go, see through this delusion of self-clinging and really let go of this holding on at the deepest possible level that we can imagine, then there are three conditions that they have sort of identified that need to be in place. Three conditions that need to be in place. Yeah. One of them is that we're working on our own practice using ethics, meditation and wisdom, that we're assiduously practicing in our own lives, so that we're really trying to put the ethical precepts into practice, we're really trying to have a effective, regular meditation practice, and we're really looking at our views. So that would be us practicing assiduously. That's one of the conditions. Unfortunately, they say that that's not going to be enough for most people. For most people, even working on ethics, meditation, and wisdom isn't going to be enough, because for most people, what Subhuti argues is that we're unlikely to have an intensity of practice that creates this breakthrough. That creates the breakthrough. Because you need a real intensity of practice to overcome this root delusion. And that's unlikely to happen if we're left to our own devices. Yeah? Because our self-centeredness, our self-clinging, goes very, 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 very deep. And what we can do is we can turn even our Dharma practice into a way of refining my own life, making me a bit happier, making me a bit brighter and better and happier. Do you see what I mean? Which is, there's nothing wrong with that. That's fantastic as far as it goes, but it's limited as long as it's still about me. Yeah? And even the Buddhist path can be made into a sort of self-oriented path, unless it's practiced with real intensity. In which case, something else probably does kind of break through. So the second condition that Subhuti outlines is serving the Dharma. And that's what I want to look at this week. He says that for most of us, we do need this assiduous Dharma practice, but that probably won't be enough. We need something more, which is we need to serve the Dharma. And I want to explore what that means. And the third condition, which I'm not going to talk about this week, but I might as well tell you, unless somebody's told you already. Does anybody know the third condition that he puts in his paper? No. The third condition that he outlines is that you need a lifestyle that supports the first two. Yeah? So that's fairly obvious. You need a lifestyle that supports the first two. A lifestyle that allows you to practice assiduously and to serve the Dharma. Yeah. But we're not going to look at that this week. We'll come back to that. Okay, so serving the Dharma. Serving the Dharma. So it'd be good to just look at what that means. What do you think it means? What might it mean? I've done enough work for now. Got to think. Yeah.
Fulfill your purpose in life.
Fulfill your purpose in life. So that's definitely something that I think lies behind the whole Dharmic kind of project, doesn't it? That if you accept this premise that our potential is enlightenment, then you could say that the whole Dharmic project is to fulfill that potential, and you could if you wanted to say that that's our purpose in life. I was arguing in the tea break that it was. So that's true, but I wonder if we can be a bit more specific about what serving the Dharma would be. I think there are more specific ways of talking about it. Yeah.
Anything practical,
yeah.
Which helps support other people's practice.
Yeah, so say a bit more.
Plenty to do around the centre, for example.
Yeah.
Just helping out around the centre, helping out on teams, these type of practical aspects.
Yeah. So that's right. So one, and why do you think that's serving the Dharma? I think you're right. But I just wonder if we can get to a sort of principle behind that. Why do you think that is serving the Dharma? Maybe it's obvious.
Because we can't get enlightened on our own. We need Sangha. We need to develop Sangha.
Yeah.
And how do we do that?
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. So hold that. I'm going to ask Andy. See what Andy was saying.
No, that is going beyond.
Hmm. Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Can you say a little bit more?
No, I think that's enough.
Okay. That is enough. So going beyond oneself. I think that is the principle behind what Sam was saying and behind what Subhuti's saying. Because Subhuti's saying that we can turn this Dharma practice still into a project about me. That won't. If we're doing that, that won't help us break through this root delusion of self-clinging and the self-clinging that goes with that. We need something to go beyond ourselves. Yeah. And one way, I'll come to you, Mac, in a second, one way of doing that is to expand our sort of sphere of concern so that it's not just us that we're concerned about, but we're concerned about something bigger, something more than us. And that usually means other people. In practice, that usually means other people. So one way we can step beyond ourselves, go beyond ourselves, is to help other people practice this, ethics, meditation and wisdom. Do you see what I mean? And in a sense, the centre here, but not just this centre, but the whole Sangha, is a field where we can help each other practice this, and in so doing, each of us be going beyond ourselves, and ourselves be working on letting go of self-clinging. It's this incredible kind of virtuous spiral that can happen in an effective sangha. And yes, that can come right down to practical things like supporting the sangha, supporting the centre, teaching, or supporting others to teach, or doing the washing up, or changing the bins, or, you know, this whole place. I mean, it's run on generosity. It's run on people helping out in those very, very practical ways. Partly that's because we don't have Well, it's not just partly. We don't have the financial resources to do it any other way. On the other hand, I'm really glad that we don't have the financial resources to do it any other way, because it forces us to rely on generosity. So nobody at the centre here is employed to teach or to, you know, keep the centre running. People are supported sometimes, their needs are sometimes met, but they're not employed in the conventional sense. So Sam's point, I think, builds on what Andy, you were saying about it's one way of going beyond yourself, not the only way of going beyond yourself, and maybe we can explore a few more in a moment, but that is one way of serving the Dharma. Matt, you were going to say something.
It's kind of like a question.
Go on.
You kind of answered it. I was thinking about the difference between the two kinds of Dharma, as in Dharma as in truth or reality, and Dharma as in teachings.
Right.
And I was a bit confused about which you're talking about serving.
Ah, yes.
I was thinking about it as you were talking then was just serving, imagining the Dharma as a person.
Yes.
How do you serve that person?
Yes, yes.
You make the world around that person better for him or her to be received, you know, so
yes.
You have a community which is kind of positive and
yeah.
open to hearing what he's got to say.
Yeah.
And people who are willing to go out of their way to facilitate this person, what they're doing, and
yeah.
that would be the way you'd serve him. So I guess I was thinking maybe you could think of it like
yes.
like that. It's
yes.
the teachings are there
yes.
to do what they do.
Yes.
To serve the teachings would be to create a community that's maximally receptive to them.
Yes. Yes. I like this notion of serving a person in the sense of when we think of serving, normally is somebody, isn't it? So I think if you think of it in terms of what would serving somebody look like, it becomes a bit clearer. But I think it's also quite an interesting question, your initial question, of what is the Dharma in this case? What is it that we're serving? Because the Dharma can, as you say, mean reality as it truly is, absolute reality, truth. It can also mean the teachings that are leading to that truth. And in a certain sense, when Subhuti here is talking about serving the Dharma, I think he's referring to both. He's referring to both. So for example, they're not incompatible. So if you're helping somebody, genuinely helping somebody, or helping a group of people, genuinely helping them, either to practice the Dharma or in any other way in their life, if there's real sense of metta, then in a sense you're serving the teachings of ethics, meditation and wisdom. You're serving the practice of those teachings. But also, I think you could say that reality itself, absolute reality, whatever that is, somewhere we're aligning ourselves with the way things are when we do that. Because if we could really see the way things are, there would just be a spontaneous wanting to help others. So, in a certain sense, you could say we're serving absolute truth, Dharma in that sense, by trying to align ourselves with that. Yeah. Tony?
It seems to me you have to go beyond the knowing intellectually. You've got to live the Dharma.
You've got to live the Dharma, that's right. And living the Dharma comes right down to very practical things, doesn't it? Very, very practical things like helping somebody when they're a bit upset or caring for somebody when they're sick, if you can, or supporting institutions that can help other people. It comes down, or just being friendly when that's all that you can do. Friendly, not just in a Buddhist centre, but friendly when you're on the tube or in the rush hour or whatever it is, friendly when you're driving a car and in traffic. In a way, it comes down to those very, very ordinary kind of practical things. It's not about doing anything other than that. And without those ordinary kind of practical things, all the theory in the world isn't going to make a difference. Yeah. That's true, and I've got a but we'll come back to that but. Yeah.
What about alleviating suffering in other contexts?
Mm. So
is serving the Dharma different to that? I mean, why wouldn't, I don't know, doing charity work for a non-Buddhist sector be different to serving the Dharma?
Yeah. So it might be serving the Dharma, and Banti and Subhuti make this point in the paper that alleviating suffering in any context, helping to help people in any context, might be seen as serving the Dharma. It could help us, because it is going beyond ourselves, which was Andy's initial kind of point. And if it's doing that, it might help us see through the delusion of fixed and separate selfhood to let go of self-clinging. Or it might not. Or it might not. This is quite a tricky kind of important point. The difference, because on the outside, the same action, say you're working for a charity helping people with mental health issues. On the outside, your work of helping people with their mental health issues could be serving the Dharma, or it might not be, and on the outside it would look the same. So somebody from the outside might not be able to tell whether your work is you serving the Dharma or not. Yeah. Now, undoubtedly, it would be good work. So even if it's not serving the Dharma, it's well worth doing, just to make the world a better place. Do you see what I mean? It's well worth doing, and nobody's knocking that. In fact, if we were all doing more of that, that would be a really worthwhile thing to be doing, and the world would be a better place. But it could still be limited if you're not working from a Dharmic perspective. Because remember, at the top of this is, well, there's meditation and there's wisdom. So if you're not trying to see through the delusion of a fixed and separate selfhood, if you're not working on your mind to create a mind that's more aware and more generous and more kind and more metaful and more creative, then even your good work for a charity might not be serving the Dharma, even though it's good work. Do you see what I mean? And that's the difference. Whether it's working to see through this delusion in this sort of framework, or whether it's just good work at its own level. And sometimes, and again, you can't tell from the outside, sometimes altruistic work is just reinforcing our sense of selfhood. Yeah? Or sometimes it's not coming from a very metaful place. People in charities and in caring professions can get into all sorts of negative mental states and sort of go about their work, their altruistic work, but it's not coming from a metaful place or a very aware place. And then it's not serving the Dharma. It's probably not even serving you very well or other people. Yeah. That doesn't help. Subhuti gives, in a way, a more pokey example in his paper. So he says, for example, you see a lot of parents make great sacrifices for their children. He teaches half the time in India, and in India with the sort of poverty that, you know, most of us will never hopefully experience, those sacrifices are very, very material. You know, people can go without food in order to provide for their children. And he says, of course, that's really noble. That's really, really commendable. But on its own, it may not be serving the Dharma. It might be, but it might not be. Because it depends on how you see your children. And sometimes people see their children, he's arguing, see what you think about this. Do you agree or not? That people can see their children as a wee extension of themselves. Yeah? As a wee, as a sort of external manifestation of their own identity. He's saying, for example, people will make, parents may make great sacrifices for their children in a way that they wouldn't necessarily make for other people's children. Yeah? That's not always true, but that's quite a pokey example of how making those sacrifices with your children is really noble, but it might not be serving the Dharma in this ultimate sense of breaking through the delusion of self, fixed and separate selfhood, letting go of self-clinging.
There's something in that, can I say something?
Yeah, do.
Just quickly, that example you gave, Savita gave, is in fact quite different from someone making a decision to go beyond themselves, because if you've got children or parents as real parents, you might just be responding on a kind of instinctive level.
Mm.
You're not necessarily, I don't necessarily make a decision to do those things. Mm. It seems a bit different.
Mm. Well, it might be instinctive. Certainly there's a deep gut instinct to protect your children, I would have thought. But probably parents do make conscious decisions about the sort of sacrifices they can make and what they can provide. As well. So I think it probably works on both levels. And remember, we're not knocking that. We're saying that's really, really good. It's just not the same as serving the Dharma, necessarily. Now, it could be. So, somebody could be trying to work on their self-clinging and working on their mind, and in that context, if they were a parent, making sacrifices to their children, that self-sacrifice could be serving the Dharma. Do you see what I mean? The same action could be serving the Dharma or not serving the Dharma, depending on the motivation and the context and the views behind that action. So you can't judge from the outside, necessarily. You'd have to understand the motivations, the perspective that person was coming from.
Sorry, but this is not very practical, is it? We're not really limiting ourselves in looking at the action, then we are looking at the intention behind the action, the purpose behind the action.
Say that's true.
What I'm saying is not that it's not just a question of doing good action.
I see what you mean. Yes,
it's a question of doing rightful action.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's where Buddhist ethics can differ from other forms of ethics, particularly in theistic religions, where you've got very clear notions of good and evil or right and wrong. There can be a whole set of rules about what constitutes a good action. In Buddhism, remember, Buddhist ethics always comes back to not just the external action, but also the motivation behind that, the mental state that action springs from. That's right. Yeah.
I'm a beginner to all this.
Oh, yeah.
And it seems like mountainous to me.
Mountainous, yeah.
Presumably this deluded self, because I can already hear my deluded self inside.
Sure.
Rebelling.
Sure, yeah.
So what does one do about this terribly rebellious...
Yeah.
In whatever way it comes at you, because mine will come at me in a perfectionism way,
sure.
You know, that I've got to do everything right, and if I don't do everything right, I might as well chuck all the toys out the pram.
Yeah.
So, how does one deal with that?
Yeah. No, well, that's a really good... that's a really, really good question, because we will, all of us, including me, have a rebellious side that doesn't want to do this. The self... really, really resists, our sense of self really, really resists.
But that would be being annihilated, right?
To our delusion, it feels like that.
Yeah.
Actually, there's nothing to annihilate, so there's only something to be, there's only a freedom to experience, because there isn't a real self to annihilate, there's only an illusion of one. But, because we're trapped in that illusion, it can feel like it's going to be annihilation. Yeah? Actually, there's nothing to annihilate. But because it can feel like I might be annihilated. I'll kick and scream often, and as you say, throw all the toys out of the pram. And all of us have different ways of doing that. All of us will have different ways of doing that. Yours, as you say, might be to be a perfectionist, etc., etc. But others will have different ways. I will have different ways. I tend to just want to stay in bed and watch DVDs and have lots of, I don't know, just pleasure, chocolate, ice cream, whatever, to not make me have to think about what's really important in life. So that's a way that I kind of rebel. I think you just asking that question, I don't know your name, say your name.
Julie.
You asking that question is you already starting to work on that. Because the part of you that's asked that question isn't just the rebellious part, it's aware of that rebellious part. You're already aware that you've got a rebellious bit of you that would rebel, could rebel. And so already by framing that question and being aware of it, it means that you're working on that. You're not necessarily lost in that. You're bringing a bit of awareness to different aspects of you. And that is critical. That awareness is really, really critical. That we try and be honest with ourselves and say, yes, look, I don't really go along with this. I don't want to do this. If we can just bring awareness, but also a kindly awareness that doesn't condemn ourselves for doing that, but is a bit kind to ourselves, if we can bring awareness and kindness, then we can start to make inroads into the parts of us that don't want to practice. We can start to become a little bit more integrated. And I think the other thing that really, really helps is coming into friendship with other people who are also practicing. Because I think other people can help us have a little bit of a more perspective on our own working ground, our own difficulties. Just so you saying that, you know, I can say, oh yes, that happens for me too. And if you get to know other people in the Sangha, you'll see that it happens for them too. And then that puts everything into a bit more perspective. And we can sit a bit lighter to it and say, okay, well, that's not the end of the world. This is difficult stuff. We're not going to get there overnight. Nevertheless, it's worth persevering with, because even if we don't get there in one go, it leads to a more fulfilling life just by practicing the path. It's worth doing. Just by practicing it, it leads to a more happy life. So I think other people can help us. Friendship can help us. Sangha can help us. And in a way, that's what, again, a lot of what happens at this centre is about, is trying to us help each other in what is a very difficult mountainous journey, if you see what I mean. Yeah, it is. But Buddhism has a very kind of lofty aim. Says this is what we're really capable of, but then it's very, very pragmatic and says yes, and we need to start off by just being a little less grumpy in the mornings or whatever it is. Do you see what I mean? And that is progress if we can do that. Or we need to try and establish a daily meditation practice, even if it's only 15 minutes or 20 minutes, and that would be real progress. And if we've already got a daily meditation practice, can we extend that by 5 minutes a day? Can we go on retreat once a year? If we're already doing that, can we make that 2 or 3 times a year? There's always another little step that we can do. So we can be very, very kind of pragmatic about it and have a certain sense of humour that we're not going to get there all in one go, and that we do have bits of us that want to rebel and run away from it all. Yeah, so thanks for asking that, Julie. Who's that? Oh, yes. Did you have a question?
I feel like you're asking me, seems like I spent my life trying to find out who I am, and now you're asking me to stop finding out who I am.
I think I'm asking you to find out who you really are.
By trying to get, I mean, I can understand the intellect to get rid of my ego. It's a sort of leap of faith that you're asking me. It sounds a bit like you're asking me just to stop thinking about my personality altogether, or who I am, to just sort of allow it and see what happens. Is that?
Well, one of the things, it's sort of in those lines, but it's not quite. Because we don't get rid of our personality, for example. We're not going to change our personality. I'm not going to suddenly, develop a different sense of humour or suddenly kind of change what I like to eat or whatever. It's not going to change those kind of preferences or personality. What Buddhism is saying is that we could start not identifying with our personality so strongly. So if we could hold who we are a bit more freely, a bit more lightly, not insist on it. Do you know what I mean? So I still like certain types of food, but I don't have to insist on it. If I'm served something else, I could be a bit lighter with what preferences I have. Do you see what I mean? If we can start to let go of the clinging to our personality, then we become a bit freer. We become a bit bigger. So it's not like we have to annihilate ourselves or... the ego, from a Buddhist perspective, doesn't exist. It's a delusion. All we have to do is just start to be a bit lighter with things. And that's what... If we start to practice ethics and meditation, that's one of the effects it has. You know, just by acting a bit more consciously and a bit more kindly, we stop being so worried about me. That doesn't mean that I disappear. That doesn't mean my life disappears or preferences disappear. Yeah. It doesn't mean that you have to give away all your possessions. But you know how sometimes... you can have possessions, but they don't mean so much. And other times people can have possessions and they're really identified by those possessions. Yeah? So their house or their car is an intrinsic part of who they think they are. Yeah? And Buddhism's saying, no, it's not. It's a house or a car. Yeah? If you can start to let go of the identification, then you can be yourself. But actually you start to become freer. And this it's interesting that this metaphor, and it is a metaphor of a suprapersonal force, it's a metaphor that something comes through us when we let go of that clinging to ourselves. And it's poetic, it's a metaphor, not literal. But imagine sunlight coming through a stained glass window. What it does is it illuminates the window and everything the other side of the window illuminates the room. But different stained glass windows will be illuminated in different ways. It's not that the stained glass window all becomes obliterated. The patterning of that window stays, but something comes through. So different people are like different stained glass windows. You see what I mean? Something new will come through. So I'm never going to be, a top musician. But somebody else who is a talented musician, how the Dharma might express itself through them might be through their musical creativity. I'm never going to be a poet, but for some people it might turn into that. Yeah, I'm not going to be a surgeon that saves people's lives. But for some people, that might be how it expresses itself. It will express itself in different ways. But how it's felt, according to this metaphor, is as if something comes through you that's more than you and acts for the good of the world. So we become sort of agents for helping create a better world. And we'll do that in our own individual ways.
What happens if you kind of get a sense of that just now and again? But most of the time it's me.
Yes.
But now and again, I get that.
Yes. And in a way, if you keep practicing the Dharma, that's what should happen. Every so often, we'll get glimpses. Every so often, we'll feel more in touch with something much bigger than us, as it were. We'll feel freer, and we'll feel probably more alive. And paradoxically, when that happens, you feel more like you're you. You're really you. You feel more like you're really you. It's not like you feel like you've disappeared, but you're you at your best. When that happens, it's a sort of, I think you can take real heart in that. You can take confidence in that, that you're on the right track. But those glimpses tend to fade. The way of this is that our sense of separate selfhood closes back again. The delusion comes back very quickly. So then we have to keep working. But it's good to remind ourselves that we did have that glimpse. Yeah? Because it gives us a little bit more confidence. So you were saying, for example, I don't know your name, sorry.
Catherine.
You were saying, you know, I'm asking you to do this. When we have those glimpses, you can build your own confidence that actually this makes sense in your experience. So then you've got a little bit more motivation to carry on practicing. What happens in time is that those glimpses happen more and more as you start to change. And they permeate your life more and more, so that they don't remain isolated glimpses. They start to affect you, you know, in your everyday life more and more. Ultimately, it's said that those glimpses become so strong that you can't go back to being the person that had the delusion. You change in a irrevocable way, and from there on in, you just keep changing and moving towards this freedom. So the glimpses count, but for most of us, they're few and far between. If you keep practicing, they become. It's like images, flashes of lightning. Sometimes, in a flash of lightning, you can see clearly. The darkness is illuminated, but then it's gone, and you're back in the darkness. And that's another image for it. But those flashes become more frequent. Once you've seen enough, you're convinced that there's something here, that it's true. Even though you're not able to live by it all the time. So I think you can take heart in those. And that's why I keep encouraging us to go on retreat, because for most people, certainly for myself, but in my experience, for most people, those flashes, those glimpses are most likely to occur when the conditions around you are the most favourable. It's not always the case. Sometimes glimpses occur in even really unfavourable circumstances. There's no kind of law around. Well, there are laws, actually, but they're not discernible to us. But they're most likely to happen in when the conditions are really, really favourable. And so you can't make it happen, but what you can do is set up the conditions for it. And retreat conditions are ideal conditions for it to happen. And sometimes Bhante talks about not just a glimpse, but a glimpse of a glimpse. And even that can be enough to convince you that there's something more. Yeah. Okay, so I just want to recap and then we'll start finishing, see if I can wind up. So serving the Dharma, it's necessary to have some sort of aspect of our life which is concerned with more than me. Yeah? Unless there's some sort of bigger aspect to our motivation, it's going to be very difficult to break through the delusion of a fixed and separate selfhood, and to let go of the me-making. It is possible, but it's unlikely, because most of us won't have the intensity of practice to do that. So for most of us, it's really important that we have some context where we can serve something more than me. And for what that comes down to is other people. Normally, I mean, it can come down in other ways, but often it comes down to practically helping other people. Yeah, the larger project is to help alleviate suffering in the world, And we can play a part, each of us can play a part in that, in whatever way. That's what serving the Dharma is, but it has to be within the context of us working on our mind to see through this delusion. Without that context, we can be doing lots of altruistic activity, which is good, but it won't be serving the Dharma, it'll be limited. Yeah? And actually, I say it's good, but it might not be even great if it's causing us to be in really negative mental states, and if we're becoming more and more frustrated and angry and bitter, then actually we're not helping. Even if we're actively campaigning for the welfare of the world, if we're doing it out of hatred, then we're not helping. Yeah. So serving the Dharma is having a context of, or having an aspect of our life where we are helping others, but in this context of also trying to work on our mind and see through the delusion of selfhood, of fixed and separate selfhood. Yeah. And one way of doing that is actually helping to spread the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha. The Dharma is teaching, to go back to Matt's point. One way is to help spread those teachings. Bhante's point is that there's a lot of people in the world who are doing altruistic work in lots of areas. And that's fantastic. But comparatively, there are very few people who are in a position to help spread the teachings of the Buddha. And the teachings of the Buddha, this path, is capable, is potentially capable of releasing us from all suffering. So it's the real, well, it's said to be the medicine for the suffering world. And there are comparatively few people doing that, relatively more people helping alleviate suffering in other ways. So what Bhante's point is that if you are in a position to help others practice the Dharma, then that would be a real good thing to do, to make that a priority. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have to teach, but you can help the context, like the centre or the Sangha, where others can teach, or, you know, people, like we've got a large class team here doing all the jobs of running the class. Similarly, we've got lots of people who volunteer at the centre. A lot of you do, I know, help out in other ways. All of that is serving the Dharma. And the other, I guess to go back to Matt's point, it's said that when you do let go of self-clinging, when you do let go of self-clinging, and when something new does arise in you, the suprapersonal force, if you want to use that metaphor, when it arises in you, then this altruistic urge to alleviate suffering becomes spontaneous in you. That is what you experience. Instead of this concern about self and me, what we experience is a spontaneous urge to help alleviate suffering in the world around us. And we'll do that in whatever way that we can, given our temperament, our personalities, our skills, our capabilities. So serving the Dharma then becomes a spontaneous action, not a practice that we have to think about, but just who we are. It becomes an expression of who we are. Yeah. So it becomes everything in a way. So do you remember at the start of the class we did the Metta Bhavana, and I was encouraging us to try and open up to Metta that's already there in the universe. Imagine that there's metta flooding every corner of space. Metta for ourselves, metta for all beings. It's always already there, if we could only open our eyes to it, open our hearts to it. That would be the experience if we let go of self-clinging. There would just be this free-flowing, spontaneous, all-encompassing, unconditional metta. And we couldn't help but act from that. And that would be, I think, a real fulfillment of human potential. of all our potential. It would be what life is about. And even if we don't all reach that in this lifetime, I don't know if I'm going to reach that in this lifetime, it seems to be worth moving towards. It seems to be worth striving for. Shall we leave it there? Maybe we'll just sit for a moment or two. We've got a couple of minutes. Let's just sit for a moment or two. And what we'll do is I'll ask Daibhadra to chant the Amitabha mantra again. So we'll chant the Amitabha mantra. During the Amitabha mantra, if you want to, you could come up and make an offering. So maybe if we're sitting near the front, make a little bit of space. And you could also leave. But we'll leave this room in silence. Well, not in silence. We'll leave to the chant of the Amitabha mantra. And then, of course, when you're outside, you can talk.
Om Mami Deva Hri. Om Mami Deva Hri. Oh.